This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 6, 1965, Part 2, with Nick Duke.
Hello and welcome back to Marvel Age Masterclass, the only podcast on Place to Be Nation Pop where you can hear comics dissected that were just dissected a week ago by four other guys. My name is Ben Morse. I am the host of Marvel Masterclass. I'm coming to you from my backyard in beautiful, hot Las Vegas, Nevada, the entertainment capital of the world. It's about 107 here. I am got a nice sweat going, and the cicadas have just started to make noise, so we should probably get down to business before they're too loud. One of those four guys, as always, is joining me, and that's Nick Duke.
What's going on, man?
Not much, man. I am excited to talk a little bit more Marvel with you, sir. Of course, we talked a lot of DC on our first episode, so we got to try to...
It seems to be a recurring theme for your show that DC inevitably works its way into the conversation.
I mean, to me, we'll get to it this episode, but to me, it's impossible to talk about just Marvel without getting into like what DC was doing. And yes, that takes us down some tangents, like talking about Kyle Rayner and Hal Jordan and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I think we need to compare. To give you guys the quick rundown of what this podcast is about, Marvel Age, our sister or mother podcast, goes year by year dissecting the Marvel Universe, beginning in 1961. We are currently up to 1965. And then I welcome one of the hosts of Marvel Age onto Masterclass, where we dive a little deeper into some of the points that were made. Talk about the characters, talk about the creators, and just try to get a feel for what I can provide with my experience of 10 years working at Marvel and what kind of stories we can get into, what kind of trouble we can get into. And Nick, I think we're going to get a lot of trouble tonight.
God, I hope so. You know, the last time out, I had a lot of fun doing this. 1965 and Marvel is obviously, I think the Sarcastic Four are in agreement at this point that it's the best year we've read so far. But this episode, I'm especially excited about talking to you because we're going to talk about my favorite characters to this point, those being Thor, Spider-Man, and Doctor Strange, as well as a pretty landmark issue of Avengers. So lots of stuff to discuss, lots to unpack.
So before we dive into that, we'll talk about it throughout the show, and you guys integrated into your episode. But I want to start off with talking about Steve Ditko, who everyone knows at this point passed away a couple weeks ago. Co-creator of Spider-Man, co-creator of Doctor Strange, landmark artist, one of the pillars of Marvel in the early days. I mean, along with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, basically created the Marvel Universe. So I'll let you go first, Nick. Let's talk a little bit about Ditko, his influence, especially I want to get from you how you've reappraised Ditko after rereading some of this early Spidey and Doctor Strange. What is your kind of new take on Ditko within the last few months after re-exploring this material?
I mean, I think most people know that Ditko, he's best known as an artist, but I think what I've come to realize through this project is he was so much more than that. Like,
absolutely.
I believe there becomes a certain point where Amazing Spider-Man, they actually credit Ditko with the plots because he was the driving force behind, you know, primarily Spider-Man and Doctor Strange at this point. And his storytelling sensibilities, not just his art, were driving those both of those characters to be, you know, two completely different things from anything else we were seeing across the comics landscape at that point. You know, you had Spider-Man, which was telling these stories that were taking a look at society and telling the story of this down on his luck, you know, high school kid who had real personal problems that were part of the book, and not even part of the book, but at times the main focus of the book, which was unheard of. And then you had Doctor Strange, which was appealing to this, you know, a little bit older counterculture audience with the, you know, psychedelic visuals and just the out there stories and plots and stuff. And it shows you a guy who could cater to so many different audiences, who had not just amazing artistic ability, but just I think he needs to go down as one of the greatest storytellers in the comics medium rather than just an artist, which he gets so much credit for.
I think it's a great way to put it. I couldn't have put it better myself, talking about Steve Ditko, the storyteller, as opposed to merely Steve Ditko, the penciler. Ditko is, he was such an opinionated person. He was so creative. Yeah. And you see that in Spider-Man, to a lesser degree in Doctor Strange. I honestly think, and this is just my, this is not based on any knowledge, I think Stan may have let Ditko drive the bus more on Doctor Strange than he did on Spider-Man. I think Ditko was eventually installed as co-plotter on Spider-Man because he was doing so much work, and I think Stan was reluctant to fully give up Spider-Man, so they coexisted for as long as they could. Mm-hmm. But to me, Strange has always felt like that's Ditko. Yeah. That's pure Ditko. Really, you know, plotting and going from there. The other thing I say about Ditko is when you look at him in contrast to Jack Kirby, which it's impossible not to do.
Right.
Because they are the two artistic influences at the beginning of the Marvel Universe. To me, Kirby was the big, bombastic action guy.
Mm-hmm.
But Ditko was the one who could really bring out the humanity of his characters. To me, he's the one who was drawing it was much more of a departure from the normal Silver Age style of comics art that you would see elsewhere, with kind of the square jawed, super heroic, everyone's a leading man, leading lady type stuff that Kirby, for all his skill, you know, was as guilty of that as anyone else. I mean, look at Fantastic Four. They're all, you know, the exception of the thing, they're all movie idols.
Yeah.
But you look at Ditko and the way he drew Spider-Man and his supporting cast, they look like normal people.
Right.
They look like real people. Like, he was very much a predecessor to the Neil Adams of the world. To the, I would look actually, you know, someone who I think is a good comparison to Ditko is Chris Weston.
Okay.
And, you know, people who have come more recently. But just that idea of, I'm going to draw out, you're going to see the flaws. Like, the villains are these grotesque characters in some ways. But even the heroes, even Peter Parker, does not look like, you know, a model.
Right.
He looks like a real teenager.
Right.
And then I think you flip over to Doctor Strange, and I think the reason that Strange works, I don't think it would have worked the same if Kirby had drawn it. Kirby definitely could have nailed some of the stuff we're going to talk about tonight, you know, when he got into kind of the big cosmic concepts. But I think the fact that Ditko could do that, but ground it with a sense of realism, like Doctor Strange still looks like a real guy. And he's facing these fantastic foes, whether it's Dormammu or Eternity or Mordo or Nightmare. There's such a contrast between the humanity that Ditko brought to his characters and would always bring to his characters, even, you know, post-Marvel, working on the Charlton characters or some of his lesser-known creations like Mr. E. They always seemed like, yes, they were crazy out there creations, but there was something real to them. And I think Ditko really, especially with Spider-Man, grounded the Marvel Universe, which is something that needed to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really the interesting thing, though, is it's his work, especially at this point in the Marvel Universe, has such a dichotomy to it, because you talk about him grounding it with Spider-Man, but then he also takes it to these otherworldly places that to this point had not really been seen with Doctor Strange. So it's like this, it's this guy walking between two worlds and just absolutely knocking it out of the park in both aspects. So it's really remarkable to look at the variety he was able to accomplish just really doing those two characters at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the variety of his work and the fact that it was all high level. He could do pretty much anything and make it look good. And you know what? I kind of like that we only got Ditko on two books, like that he wasn't as spread as thin as Kirby. I mean, Kirby is a unique talent in that I think he could juggle, you know, 9 books or whatever a month and bring something to each of them. Ditko probably could. But there was something about having him on less books and making him feel more special, more like a treat, that I think really worked in his favor.
Well, and even by this point, you know, in 1965 that we're going to talk about tonight, you see Jack Kirby start to pull back from that a little bit. I mean, that kind of workload is not something that is really sustainable. I mean, compare that to what, how artists work today. I mean, the very idea that Jack Kirby was drawing upwards of 5 monthly books at a time is just, it's ridiculous. When you have artists today that can't get a monthly book out on time, just doing one book at a time, it just speaks to how different the comics industry was back then and how much it has evolved since then. But you're right. I mean, Steve Ditko, to get back to that point, having him on only these two books, I think it enabled him to give his absolute 100% every time out, and also, like you said, made him feel more special. Because I know even 50 years later, every time I look at one of these reading lists and there's some Ditko Doctor Strange on it, I know going in I'm going to really, really enjoy it, at least from an artistic standpoint.
Yeah. Agreed on all things Ditko. He was a genius. He was a giant. It almost feels weird to be like, oh, he will be missed or anything like that, because he was so far removed from comics that it doesn't really feel like, oh man, this is like a loss that we're really going
to
feel.
I mean, it sucks to say it, but doesn't it feel kind of like he's been gone for years already?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And you know, I don't have any Steve Ditko stories from working at Marvel. I wish I did. But no, I never had any contact with him whatsoever. I don't think most people who worked there did. He was just, the interesting thing was we knew where he worked. Like, we knew where his office was. Like, we had the address of his office, I think, because we were still sending royalty checks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And some people, like, I remember Tom Brennan, who was an assistant editor and eventually an editor on the Spider-Man books when I was there. I think at one point he went and, like, knocked on the door, but, like, no one answered. So it was, like, the ultimate Steve Ditko story. You know, he got nothing out of it.
Yeah.
I'll end with a trivia question. Who was Steve Ditko's last great creation for Marvel?
Oh, for Marvel. God, you're gonna stump me on this one. I'm going to guess, take a wild shot in the dark and say, oh, let's see. I'll go Mary Jane.
Ditko came back for a few shots in the 80s.
That's right.
And for the most part, it was working on established characters.
Right.
But in one story, he co-created the unbeatable Squirrel Girl. So that was Ditko's last contribution to Marvel. I always thought that was kind of cool, because it's like,
I think I got that mixed up, but I had Steve, but I, for some reason, I thought it was a Gerber and not a Ditko. So there you go.
No, Squirrel Girl was a Ditko, and I thought always the great thing about that was he contributed, you know, all these weighty, emotional, conflicted characters with Spider-Man and his villains and his supporting cast and Doctor Strange and all these epic characters, and he went out on this cult classic, you know, upbeat, positive character who to this day is a fan favorite, and maybe one of his most lasting legacies, which is great.
Yeah, and somebody who apparently is set to get the live action treatment in a show that's going to come to the eventual Disney streaming service whenever that launches. So that should be interesting.
So there you go. We'll see Squirrel Girl live on. But we are not talking about what's coming out in the future. We're talking about what came out decades in the past. Again, before you jump in, you guys want to listen to the latest episode of Marvel Age, where they cover the first half of 1965. We're now going to dive into the second half of 1965. And let's start with Earth's Mightiest Heroes, as you guys did. Mm-hmm. And that means we're talking to Mick about Avengers number 16. Now, this is a historic issue, one we've kind of been waiting for. I feel like every episode we tease something big's coming in Avengers, and this is where something big indeed came in Avengers, as the entirety of the original remaining cast of Iron Man, Wasp, Giant Man, and I guess Thor didn't leave in this issue, but left soon after. Mm-hmm. I think he leaves in the next issue because he's off in another dimension during this one.
Yep.
But they're all gone. Captain America gets a new team of recruits. It's Hawkeye. It's Scarlet Witch. It's Quicksilver. It's Cap's Kooky Quartet. Basically, what happens here is Avengers goes from being Marvel's answer to Justice League, which is all the big solo heroes in one book together, to being something wholly different. And that was this kind of ragtag team, didn't really fit, three former villains, one character who's just a paragon of virtue trying to work with them, and just kind of doing their own thing. Now, the interesting thing to me here is, again, in a lot of ways, this would set a template for teen books to come. Because the reason, to my understanding, that Stan Lee made this change was he wanted to leave the big moments for the bigger characters in their own titles. Like, he didn't want to do something big with Iron Man in Avengers when he could just do it in Tales of Suspense. He wanted some characters he could play with a little more. So he took characters he liked that he had created in other books, Hawkeye from Iron Man, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch from X-Men, and basically now he could do this more ongoing, more soap. You'll notice in the subsequent issues, it immediately gets much more soap opery.
Mm-hmm.
Many more like romantic stuff with Hawkeye and Scarlet Witch, and just the ability to do more with these characters. Now, the reason this was so influential is you would eventually see Justice League go this way,
mm-hmm.
but it took a while. Immediately after this, you did have a lot of Justice League writers, classic writers, guys like Steve Englehart and Jerry Conway and the like. You know, they would kind of catch on to what Stan was doing, in the sense that they would bring in characters like a Red Tornado or a Zatanna and make them kind of the centerpiece of the book,
mm-hmm.
because they could basically mess around with them,
mm-hmm.
whereas they couldn't do anything with Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, etc.
Well, I think you had them take a lead from that in terms of rotating the roster and turning it over. But to my knowledge, this whole, you know, making the team up primarily of former villains thing, unheard of at this point. I mean, I think that's my biggest takeaway here.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point, is that while Justice League introduced the, you know, more the characters they could touch more in the book, they never jettisoned the Big Seven.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they never kind of pulled the ripcord and said, all right, we're going to see how this book does with just these lesser characters.
Right.
And that was what was different about Avengers, was it wasn't, all right, we're going to keep Thor and Iron Man around, but add some of these new characters. And if they're not as popular, well, we still have Thor and Iron Man. It was, no, we're getting rid of all the big characters, and we're going to make this book solely focus on, as you said, a team of former villains.
Right. Yeah, it was so risky. I mean, looking back on it now anyway, I mean, I don't know how risky it was considered at the time. I don't know what the sales on Avengers were like or anything like that. But looking back at it now, to not only turn over the entire roster practically in the course of a year, but then to also, populate the roster with former villains and align them with a character in Captain America who hadn't been appearing, you know, up until the year before in monthly comics in decades, essentially, that's a pretty ballsy move on Stan's part. And it definitely, like you said, freed him up to do pretty much whatever he wanted to with Avengers. And it makes me very interested to see how Avengers evolves as a title going forward. Because to this point, I would say, based on the stuff we've read for our reading list, Avengers has been historically relevant, but not necessarily the highest quality book on our reading list. And I'm wondering if perhaps that takes a little turn here.
Absolutely. I'm going to be very interested to see what's coming up with Avengers, because much in the same way we talked about last episode, how early X-Men is a mm-hmm. lot better than we thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now that kind of the shackles are off, and I feel like Stan, and to a lesser extent Jack, and I don't know how much longer Jack stays on Avengers, but I feel like Stan's getting to write the type of book he wants to write. Now, the only thing I'll say, and I'm going to touch on this with another character who we're going to discuss later in this episode, I don't know if Avengers, even as it was composed, was scratching the itch completely for Stan, because he already had Fantastic Four.
Right.
So he already kind of had his team book, and even he had X-Men, where he could explore other stuff. But I do think, you know, putting the roster this way, bringing in some interesting characters, characters who really weren't getting a chance to fully shine in their books. Like, mm-hmm. we got teases of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch and X-Men, but we didn't really, you know, we didn't get to see them as protagonists. Obviously, Hawkeye, as we discussed, early appearances were not necessarily the best, but he becomes an Avenger staple. And it's just interesting to think of how this risk, how this gamble, we don't know how it's going to pay off initially. And I'm curious to see how good the stories get, if they are on the same level as those early X-Men. But we do know, without a shadow of a doubt, that at least with two of the characters, with Hawkeye and Scarlet Witch, we get Avengers mainstays out of mm-hmm. this, characters who will forever be associated with the Avengers, even on, you know, even on the big screen. You know, Quicksilver is in his own category, but Hawkeye and Scarlet Witch certainly are readily associated with Avengers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to the point that, I mean, Hawkeye we saw as early as the first Thor movie when it came time for the MCU to become a, you know, become a thing. Hawkeye is a character who, you know, when I think of the Avengers, I always picture Hawkeye as being there. Scarlet Witch, not so much, even though I know she's a mainstay, but you're absolutely right. Both of those characters, I would argue at this point, are more associated with the Avengers than they are any other aspect of involvement in the Marvel Universe. I mean, I guess you could argue about that with Scarlet Witch. Some people will say she's more associated with the X-Men or what have you. But when I think of both of those characters, I think of Avengers. So,
absolutely. And Hawkeye for me was always the quintessential Avenger.
You're right.
He was the guy that every, I mean, Captain America in some ways is the quintessential Avenger, but eventually Cap would also get his own solo series. Hawkeye, for the most part, has been a guy who, if you wanted to read the adventures of Hawkeye up until very recently,
you had to follow
Avengers in order to get him. And I agree with you. Scarlet Witch was not necessarily, to me, as much of a you know, mainstream Avenger. And mm-hmm. I think that's why she's, you know, comes in the second movie and not the first. But Hawkeye, for sure. Probably my favorite Avengers character growing up.
Wow.
I always liked Hawkeye. I thought the archery angle was cool.
Mm-hmm.
I thought just kind of the idea of this brash, kind of non-powered Robin Hood figure. I like the fact that, this is going to sound bad, but I like the fact that he's kind of dumb. Compared to all these geniuses.
Yeah, that's true.
Despite the fact that he did have a lab in his first appearance. But I like the fact that this was the kind of guy who was, he would fall in love very quickly and very hard mm-hmm. and would make bad decisions as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Fraction and Aja's eventual take on Hawkeye was kind of everyone's take on Hawkeye taken to the extreme.
Right.
Like
right.
He really was the everyman Avenger mm-hmm. who made bad decisions and was just kind of this likable loser. I think they tapped into what made Hawkeye work. Mm-hmm. And I think he always, to some degree, you know, kind of shined in Avengers because of those reasons.
You know, I definitely always think of him when I think of Avengers, because as we did, I don't know if you remember this, because as we discussed on Hard Traveling Fanboys a couple of years ago, he was on the classic Captain America and the Avengers side-scrolling arcade game that had
the video games.
It was him, Vision, Iron Man, and Captain America. And so, for whatever reason, those are the first four.
That's why him and Vision were always Avengers to me.
Yeah, exactly, because that was my first exposure to the Avengers as a concept when I was a young kid. Yeah. So, and I played the hell out of that game.
It was an awesome
game. So fond memories of Hawkeye in that context, for sure.
I would say Captain America and the Avengers, the video game, was probably the best representation of Avengers, including the comics, for many years.
Yeah.
It was that good. It was so fun.
And it cemented the white suit version of the Vision in my head in a way that I don't really know it necessarily deserves, because now looking back on it, I love the green and red and yellow classic design so much more. But for whatever reason, that white suit design, just because of childhood nostalgia, is always cemented in my memory.
If I had encountered Vision first in the comics with the white suit, I would be like, what's this guy looks weird.
Yeah.
He looks unsettling. I don't like it. But because it was in a video game, yeah, I'm the same as you. I was always like, white suit Vision, let's do it.
Yep.
Before we move out of the Avengers section, I want to ask, have you ever read Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes by Joe Casey and Scott Collins?
I have not.
I'm going to recommend that you try to read that.
Okay.
ASAP.
Okay.
Not ASAP. Read it whenever you want. It's really good. And the thing about that book is, I know on Marvel Age, you guys kind of, one of the things you were down on was that Iron Man and Giant Man and Wasp just kind of depart kind of suddenly without any real explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Earth's Mightiest Heroes is basically Joe Casey and Scott Collins breaking down and looking at the early days of the Avengers from like a modern lens. So they try to account for a lot of the decisions that took place, basically, for lack of a better term, off camera.
When was that published?
Original book. What's
when,
that?
When was the story published?
I want to say 2005.
You know, it, now that you're describing it to me, it sounds very familiar, but I can't, you know, I honestly can't remember if I read it or not.
It was right after Scott Collins came to Marvel because he had been at DC for a while,
right?
Drawing Flash. It was like his first big post Flash project. Like, I know he did a few issues of Avengers with Jeff Johns and with Chuck Austin,
mm-hmm.
but this was like his big chance to really let loose. And Scott Collins is one of my favorite artists of all time.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
So I just to me, he is the Flash artist. And it was his chance to cut loose. But the cool thing to our interest tonight is that Joe Casey gives a lot more weight to Iron Man in particular and why he left the team early on. And he does a really good job of making it seem like a natural decision. So definitely, if that's a good series for anyone who's listening to read, is Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes by Joe Casey and Scott Collins. Check it out on Marvel Unlimited. Yes, let's move on to one of the guys you wanted to discuss,
mm-hmm.
and that is the amazing, spectacular web of Spider-Man. Spidey, not his strongest issues,
mm-hmm.
in 1965. We do get a trilogy of a Green Goblin trilogy,
mm-hmm.
which I think is just okay,
mm-hmm.
because of what you guys said on Marvel Age, and that's the fact that Green Goblin has not really popped as a villain yet.
No.
I think we're still in kind of the proto stages. The thing that makes Green Goblin work, ultimately, as a Spider-Man villain, what he has that no other Spider-Man villain has is his secret identity and his ties
right.
to Peter Parker.
Right. I would argue that Green Goblin, that Norman Osborn works because of Harry Osborn. That's always been my take on it anyway. And
that's a good take.
That's why in these early stages, because Harry isn't in the book and we don't know anything about Norman Osborn. So you just kind of have the Green Goblin as this cackling, mustache twirling villain who has these kind of ham-fisted plots and stuff. And it's just, it's not working to this point, but I'm so excited to start to get into some of the formative stuff. I believe in 1966, the next year we're going to cover, that actually has the reveal of Norman Osborn as the Green Goblin, and you start to see that character slowly evolve into what he's going to become. But you're right. These early Green Goblin stories just not really hitting the mark for me, but at least visually they're starting to evolve the character as they've already moved to the classic glider away from the flying broomstick that we saw in his initial appearances.
Yeah, and visually he's an interesting villain because, again, he's a Ditko design.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem was all the best villains at Marvel at this point were fleshed out characters, guys who were really could have been part of the cast. They were part of the cast. Doctor Doom is part of the cast of Fantastic Four. Magneto is part of the cast of X-Men. There really were no memorable Avengers villains, and I would argue that's because they didn't feel like an ongoing part of the book. They tried to do it with Baron Zemo, Masters of Evil, and it didn't stick. But Green Goblin is not so much a character at this point as he is a gimmick. And I think the gimmick, and I'm not talking about the gimmick of being a goblin, the gimmick of being creepy, any of that stuff. The gimmick is that we don't know who he is.
Right.
Like, it's a very one-note gimmick. And to Stan and Steve's credit, to do the long game that they wanted to do, which was to make his reveal of who he is actually matter, they needed to build up stories with him as us not knowing who he is.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a double-edged sword because in order to build him up, they had to keep him a mystery. But in order to keep him a mystery, it almost made the character uninteresting because there's not a lot to him.
Yeah, and you couldn't, by the same token, you couldn't just have Norman Osborn appear in every one of his stories, or else it would have, you know, telegraphed the reveal. So you're kind of working in this limbo right now where you don't have Norman, you don't have the Goblin's identity revealed, and so you're kind of just having to tread water until you can get to that reveal. So yeah, I think you're on
exactly
there.
Treading water is a perfect term for it. I think Stan in particular knew they were sitting on a great payoff, and that once they revealed him, this would become a great villain. And we'll talk more about the reveal when we get there and kind of, you know, Stan and Steve's divide on it. But I think, you know, they were really operating under their, like, well, we can't reveal this guy, but if we're going to make the reveal mean something, we have to have him show up every few issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I'm intrigued to get there eventually on that reveal, because I've heard so many things about the divide, you know, between Stan and Steve and how that all came about. And I think it's interesting to look at these particular issues because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've always understood is that Steve Ditko just wanted it to be, quote, some guy, you know, just some random reveal. And that's kind of what you get here with the Crime Master in this series of issues. So it's almost like if they had just gone forward with Green Goblin just being some guy, that would have been two big reveals in a row of just some guy. And that would have felt a little bit, I don't know, in hindsight, it feels like it probably would have rang a little hollow.
I think it would absolutely have rung hollow. I think, you know, I get Ditko's argument to an extent that he wanted to... Ditko was always more about making a point than making money, if that makes sense. Because obviously the money is in having it be a member of Spider-Man's supporting cast. That's where you get the more intriguing stories. That's where you get people more interested. But Ditko was more concerned with the idea of showing that evil is not, it doesn't make sense. It's random. It's chaos. Right. It's the guy you don't know is trying to ruin your life for no reason. It's not the crazy coincidence that it happens to be your best friend's father.
Right.
But that's comics, you know, like that's what makes comics work, is things that stretch the credibility like that. And I would argue to another extent, like, you know, that's why people like soap opera. That's why people like wrestling.
You're right.
Because it doesn't make sense. It's completely strained in terms of credibility, but it's the best storytelling option.
Absolutely. If we wanted, you know, random things happening for no seemingly, you know, no reason, we would just live our normal lives and not escape into these forms of entertainment.
And that's, I mean, ironically, that's what Ditko wanted. He's like, I want to make a point that we need to make these comics like real life. And so many of us turn to comics as an escape from real life. Like, that's not what we want to see at all. So we want to see it go a different way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like that you bring up Crime Master, because I think he basically, I wonder, and I think you guys already speculated this, so I'm not going to take credit for thinking of this, but I wonder if that wasn't Stan's kind of peace offering to Ditko I think it had to be, right?
I definitely get that vibe. I mean, knowing what we know now anyway, at the time, nobody had the ability to know the inner workings or know the story of the split, and nobody even knew that the split was coming back then. But looking back on it with all the hindsight, it kind of just feels that way, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like it has to be. It has to be like Ditko. And the funny thing about, from what we know of Ditko, he dug his heels in so much and really, you know, did not give an inch, that I bet to this day, or too recently because he just passed away, Ditko would probably claim that Crime Master was a better reveal than Green Goblin.
Well,
I think I'd absolutely stick to his guns on that.
You know, you're probably right based on what I know about him.
Yeah, I mean, that's unfair to say because we obviously don't know Steve Ditko.
Right.
And we've now moved into the speaking ill of the dead portion of,
we're not really speaking ill. He was a pretty notorious guy for having strong opinions about things and not really backing down off of them. So I don't think
sticking to his guns on him. All right, you persuaded me. We are not speaking ill of the dead. Mm-hmm. We're just, you know, characterizing them as kind of stubborn, intractable. The other issue of Spider-Man that comes out, it's interesting because it's another, and you guys talked this one to death, but it's another lame villain issue.
Yeah.
But it's also one of my sentimental favorite Spider-Man issues of the period.
And I can absolutely understand that. Like, the villain sucks, but the story is fantastic, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, Molten Man completely uninspired. Probably Stan and Steve spent so much of their time crafting this awesome personal mm-hmm. exploration into Peter Parker's life, mm-hmm. his high school graduation, the revelation with Liz Allen, which I love, and we'll talk about in a sec, all the good stuff with Jonah, with Aunt May, that probably by the time they remembered they had to put a villain in this issue, mm-hmm. they were just like, oh, you know,
whatever, something,
some dude. And Ditko gave him a decent visual, and, you know, he's fine.
Maybe Stan or Steve just walked by and saw an issue of Green Lantern with Goldface on it. And they were like, that'll work. Goldface. Let's do our own version of Goldface.
Yeah, Goldface will work, said no one ever. the beauty of this issue is, once again, Spider-Man and Peter Parker get to break ground in comics mm-hmm. as Peter Parker gets to be the first comic book hero, first teenage character in particular, who really gets to grow up, mm-hmm. who gets to move beyond high school. And it was so, I mean, think about the fact that at this point in the 1960s, you had, this is going to come out of left field, but you had Archie, mm-hmm. which was already like 20 or 30 years in at this point, and was making significant success and money, probably not, you know, breaking the bank, but Archie did fine for himself off the fact these characters were perennially in high school. And you had this kind of safe setup. You had this ready-made supporting cast, ready-made location, ready-made dynamic of kids in school that you could play with. And the high school thing made sense. So I would almost argue, we talked earlier about how Avengers was Stan kind of showing some brass ones in terms of splitting off the whole team. I would say Stan and Steve graduating Peter Parker out of high school and kind of removing him from this safe haven they'd created over several years mm-hmm. was a very risky move. And the fact that they would have to introduce a whole new supporting cast, they would have to introduce a whole new locale. And just the fact that writing stories about a college student is inherently different than writing stories about a high school student. I think this was a big risk. And, I think it paid off.
No doubt. I mean, like you said, the biggest thing here is that we're going to see over the next year or so the supporting cast be greatly overhauled. I mean, you're still going to have J. Jonah Jameson. You're still going to have Betty Brant for a little bit, Aunt May. You know, there are going to be some pretty reliable constants in his life. But you're also going to see, like you see here, Liz Allen leave the book. You're going to see Flash Thompson take on a little bit of a different role. You're going to see new characters come in. I mean, it's just... it is remarkable to think about the idea that Spider-Man at this point, from what everything I understand, was both a critical and commercial smash success, and yet they're changing, you know, almost half the book here in this one issue.
Right.
It just goes to show you that at this point they were so confident in their storytelling sensibilities that it didn't feel, you know, risks didn't feel risky because everything they were doing was working. And so you get to do things like this because you have this self-assurance that, no, this is going to work because almost everything else we're doing at this point is a home run. So I can't wait to delve more into this in the years to come, to look more at the college age Peter Parker years. You made reference earlier to the Liz Allen thing, which is tremendously interesting and made me, you know, one thing that we talked about on the episode a little bit was I almost wondered at one point if the dueling love interests of the early pages of Spider-Man didn't have their own champions in Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. If perhaps Stan didn't have something of an affinity for Betty Brant and Steve didn't have something of an affinity for Liz Allen. It just kind of made sense in my head for some reason.
I think that makes total sense. I mean, I think in the future when it becomes two other characters, we can talk about the fact that there was definitely a character that Stan championed, and there was definitely a character that Steve's successor on the book, John Romita, championed. Mm-hmm. But here, I think it's definitely a possibility. I think, you know, Stan was a little older, so probably, you know, the idea of his of dating the secretary mm-hmm. was appealing to him. Whereas Steve, a bit younger, mm-hmm. probably romanticized the idea that, yeah, the prettiest girl in high school, the cheerleader, was really into this nerd. but
and who also has like all these personal problems. Like that's the thing about Liz Allen is she's always got something going on that you never really know what her deal is until God, what is it, decades later?
Yeah. And I love the fact that I don't know, this issue to me just made, for some reason, it just made Liz Allen seem so real.
Mm-hmm.
Like she seemed like a girl you knew just by her making herself vulnerable and admitting to Peter, like, I wish you had given us a chance. And when the strip started, she was very much just, you know, the prototypical pretty stuck up rich girl.
Yep.
Who didn't want to give Peter the time of day. But her evolution, I mean, look at a character like Flash Thompson, who great character, but not from here to there in Spider-Man. He would progress later, but at this point, he's still pretty much the character he started out as. Whereas Liz Allen really underwent a transformation and really became a massive character.
One other thing I wanted to get your impression on, is there a character in all of the Amazing Spider-Man that Stan writes better than J. Jonah Jameson?
Is there a character in comics that's better than J. Jonah?
That's an even better way to put it.
I think is the real question.
I should have seen J. Jonah Jameson as the commencement speaker coming a mile away. And the fact that I didn't, and it worked so well and was so hilarious. It was one of my favorite things they've done in this book. It's a small little gag, but man, it was perfect.
I love the little thing about Jameson. You know what I think I love most about Jameson is the fact that J. Jonah Jameson is the hero of his own story,
right? Yes.
Very much.
Yes.
Like, he does not see this overbearing jerk that the rest of us see. When he says stuff like, man, if only I wasn't such a sweetheart, like, he genuinely believes that. Like, J. Jonah Jameson thinks he is a great humanitarian.
Right.
And I don't know, that he is one of the best characters. He's one of the best he might be the best supporting character in comics. A lot of competition there.
I would definitely I would have him up there in terms of in the Marvel universe for sure. I think he's the best. And
for sure.
I think you'd have to go over to like DC with like Alfred or Lois Lane, but it would be like
the truly iconic supporting character.
He would be definitely a top five in comics and have a strong argument for number one.
I think he's in the conversation for sure. I want to talk about with this issue. I don't know. Just the fact that, you know, what's amazing to me, to kind of get back to what we were saying a little while ago and talk about, you know, the supporting cast and how fearless these creators were and how bold they were moving forward. The craziest thing to me is probably the best Spider-Man supporting characters are still to come.
Mm-hmm.
Like aside from Jonah and Aunt May, like the college era characters are, you know, no offense to the initial characters, but so much more interesting than Liz and Betty and even Flash, although Flash stick around. So he got to kind of grow and become a great character, but it's almost like you talk about them being fearless and kind of blowing up the setup, but in a way it's also Stan and Steve saying, you know what, now that we've been writing and drawing this book for a couple of years, we could probably create a better supporting cast.
Right.
So let's just start over and let's cheat. Like it could literally been them having that conversation saying, like, you know, we're kind of bored of the supporting cast. What's a good way to get rid of all of them without, you know, a wholesale slaughter of the cast? Is, oh, we can just graduate him from high school to college and then create all new, better characters for him to interact with.
And it's also kind of brilliant because the audience they had built at this point, if you were a high schooler reading this book, you've grown up with this character for 4 years. So it's almost like Peter Parker is growing up with you. It's like he's a contemporary of yours. And as you're going through these changes in life, so is he. And so it's this very unique thing in comics, whereas, I mean, like we said, look at DC. You know, Batman, Superman, Green Lantern, all these characters who were constants for years. Now, granted, at this point, you know, not as, roughly a decade for DC up to this point, but like, over in Marvel, whether it's the wedding of Reed and Sue, whether it's the X-Men getting to graduate from the Xavier Institute, whether it's this with Peter Parker going on to college, you get the impression that you are on legitimate life journeys with these characters and that you're not trapped in this endless cycle. Now, eventually we get there because the only way for comics to endure is for it to be something, you know, akin to that.
Yeah.
But at this point, compared to everything else that everyone else was doing, it just feels so unique and so, it feels like an earned journey that you're on with these characters. And it's really remarkable to look back on.
Yeah, and not to jump too far ahead, and then we'll talk about some other characters, but I mean, look at what it did to Spider-Man in the sense that it didn't stop here. He kept growing up. Even after Stan left the book, he went through college, he went through grad school, he got married.
Right.
He was an adult. And then eventually you got to the point where the people editing and writing him were like, wait a minute, we grew up with a younger Peter Parker. Right. We want to get him back to that.
Right.
Which is a discussion we'll get to someday, hopefully, if we don't. Can we get canceled? We can't get canceled, right?
I don't think we can, especially with the stuff that we have coming in the works that I wanted to throw the tease out there for.
I think we're the masters of our own destiny, so we will eventually get to that. But it's interesting. I do think there is something to what you're saying, the fact that you grew up with Peter Parker, you get to go to high school, you get to go to college. It's interesting for us years later, though, to be viewing it through the lens of, you know, we're not high school students, but we're reading about high school Peter Parker, and I think it's a to how compelling he is that we still enjoy this material.
I'm always going to have a soft spot for high school Peter Parker, because as anybody who's listened to me talk about comics ever knows, I was brought into comics through Ultimate Spider-Man. I was in high school when that happened. Like, it has always been, when I think of Spider-Man, I think of high school. And I understand that really, if you look at the mainstream, the 616 version of Spider-Man, for lack of a better term, high school is a relatively minor part of his publishing history. It's the foundation, but in terms of issues, you know, number of issues printed, most of his existence comes in college and after. But for me, Spider-Man as a concept has always been a high school concept. And I think that's why going back and reading these early stories has really spoke to me, at least in terms of the setting.
Well, speaking of things that spoke to you, I'm sure that you enjoyed the hell out of this particular year's, well, we had already talked about one of the annuals last episode. That was the Fantastic Four annual. Mm-hmm. But this time around, we got another big annual. And these annuals at this point were, as we've discussed in past episodes, they were big events. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, the origin of Namor, the origin of Doctor Doom, the wedding of Reed and Sue, the first appearance of the Sinister Six. So you had to wonder what Journey into Mystery was going to pull out to compete with those other stalwarts. And what they did was they brought in the character of Hercules, and they basically produced a book-length epic of Thor and Hercules, two incredibly strong, incredibly brash, incredibly egotistical characters, just beating the holy hell out of each other all the way from Asgard to Olympus, and Jack Kirby just in his glory, getting to draw some of the best stuff he had worked on. As a Thor fan, how much of a sweet spot did this hit
for you? Oh, this is fantastic. I mean, when you think of this classic Silver Age Jack Kirby Thor, this is one of the first things that pops to mind, because yes, you think of all the wonderful architecture that he often gets to draw in Asgard, and all the different settings and all the different places, the realm hopping he can take you to. But you also think of just dynamic action sequences. And this is, for my money anyway, one of the best Thor action sequences of the first, like, 15 to 20 years of Thor storytelling. It's basically one long, roughly 20-page fight scene that just builds and builds and builds to this crescendo where you're like, at every moment, every time you think, okay, there's nowhere else they can take this, he just steps it up a notch. And it just, it becomes this thing that is just truly breathtaking to behold at a certain point. Like, I've read it, God knows how many times at this point, because there are still Thor books that I like to go back and revisit from time to time. But the moment when Thor literally rips up the ground from underneath Hercules's feet and pulls it out from under him like a carpet is still one of my favorite moments in comics, just because of how inventive it is, the way that Jack draws it. Everything about this issue, man, it's just fantastic. And plus, you start to see the expansion of going beyond just the Norse mythology in the Marvel universe. You start to see the Greek mythology, and we'll see mythology as a concept become a bigger and bigger part of Marvel, which is another thing that sets them apart from DC, yeah. you know, their own little takes on these classic mythological stories that a lot of people, you know, at least had fundamental knowledge of.
Yeah, I like that they didn't shy away from that. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like the you would see versions of Hercules and of the Norse gods and the Greek gods in particular with mm-hmm. Wonder Woman would right. show up in DC, but they'd always be villains or supporting characters. They'd never be headliners the way Thor and eventually Hercules would become. And to me, again, that was something like you said, it made Marvel different. They weren't afraid to tap in to these concepts and say, all right, how can we make them work in the context of the Marvel universe? How can we take a Thor and ground him with some of the things they did in terms of making him Don Blake and, you know, making him have to learn humility and all this other stuff. Sticking with this issue for a sec, I love the fact that we had just gotten year previous a great Hulk versus Thing fight.
Mm-hmm.
And Hulk versus Thing was kind of the standard for Kirby drawing these big extended fight scenes that, like you said, he would become noted for, and this would become kind of his signature. What I like about Thor versus Hercules is that it stands out from Hulk versus Thing in the sense that Hulk versus Thing is, you know, powerhouse versus underdog.
Mm-hmm.
It's Thing having to fight smart because he's never going to be as strong mm-hmm. as Hulk. With Hercules and Thor, these guys are literally opposite numbers of each other.
Yes.
Like, they can keep punching each other and throwing shit at each other, and it doesn't matter because they're both equally strong.
Right.
Anything Thor can do, Hercules can do. Anything Hercules can do, Thor can do. To the point where it made sense that the fight doesn't really get stopped by, like, a knockout or anything like that. You have to have, to use a wrestling term, outside interference.
Right.
You have to have that come down. But I think there was something cool about, you know, especially if you're a fan of Thor, who's this big, massive, powerful character, getting to see someone who's his equal. And also the fact that even if you did see Thor up against other strong characters, you never saw him against a strong character who was also a good guy.
Right.
So he had a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Hercules had a legitimate shot against Thor. They're both these outsized mythological giants who could really just continue hitting each other, you know, for eternity. And mm-hmm. it was great.
I think Thor is a lot like Superman in the regard that his most interesting villains are the villains that can challenge him emotionally and intellectually, and not necessarily the villains that are sheer physical threats. Like, I've never been a guy who's a big Mangog fan or anything like that.
Sure.
Because
okay.
You know, Thor to me is a character who it's just so hard to suspend disbelief that he could be physically threatened by pretty much anything. But, you know, you can emotionally get at him. You can throw him off his game inside his head. There are different ways to sure. attack him using his massive ego. And so to this point in Thor's publishing history, you hadn't really seen him physically challenged. And so here in this Hercules book, to see him with a matched up against a foe who, like you said,
it's
is a good
a
guy. Right. And who is every bit his equal. It's the first time we've really seen it. And so there's this genuine intrigue, and the fight is so damn good that even though it does have, you know, like you said, outside interference, a little bit of a dusty finish, you don't necessarily care because the journey that you went on was worth it.
Yeah, the journey into mystery.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I love this issue. I love Thor against Hercules in general.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'm on a Scott Collins kick this particular thing because I'm thinking of Thor Blood Oath by Michael Avon Oeming and Scott Collins,
right.
where there's a great Hercules versus Thor issue. The one thing that's noteworthy, I would say, also about this issue is mm-hmm. that if you've read modern comics and you are a fan of, say, Greg Pak and Fred Van Lente's Hercules,
mm-hmm.
that is not the Hercules you get here.
No.
In terms of personality.
No.
He really is just Thor mm-hmm. version 2.0. He's another Thor for Thor to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan doesn't make him stand out. I think Hercules would suffer over his first couple decades of existence in the Marvel Universe by the fact that he was always seen as, well, if you can't get Thor, you can just slot in Hercules. He was very much the B-team Thor. It wouldn't be until the 80s and writers like Roger Stern on Avengers would really lean into the aspects of the mythology that Thor was, that Hercules was, you know, such a raging ladies' man, just, you know, would go after anyone, and kind of almost making him Thor's Thor in the sense that, you know, Thor liked the ladies, so Hercules loved the ladies. Mm-hmm. Thor had a big ego, so Hercules had an even bigger ego.
Right. That's the thing. All the things that most characters find annoying about Thor, Hercules takes them to such a degree that Thor finds them annoying. You know,
exactly.
He's a great foil. But you're right. That doesn't really come along for a long time. But once it finally does, it's totally worth it. Like, it totally reshapes that character and makes him stand apart.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting because we're going to read about, depending on what our reading lists give us, we're going to see some Hercules in Avengers coming up. Mm-hmm. He is in Avengers for a good long stretch. And I'm interested to see, because I've never read those issues. I'm interested, and I don't know if you have, I'm assuming no.
I probably have, because they were on a Thor chronology I did a long while back, where I read, every book that Thor appeared in from Journey into Mystery 108 up through... What was it? Up through the Thunderstrike days, which killed my will to continue. Oh.
Wow. No, you know what? You might not have read these issues, though, because there are issues of Avengers that have Hercules and not Thor.
Okay, then yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, because he like, literally in the next, it might be as soon as 66, he joins he's basically an ally alongside the Cap's Kooky Quartet. And we can talk when we get there about whether or not, you know, the Stan was hurting for lack of Thor and Avengers and kind of brought Hercules in as a substitute. But we'll get there. But Thor versus Hercules, always good stuff. More good stuff. And Nick, I know that I'm going to kind of let you loose on this one, because I know, given your praise, your effusive praise on Marvel Age, over in Strange Tales, Lee and Ditko really expanded the world of Doctor Strange. He went on a 12-part quest, mm-hmm. or journey or adventure, where ultimately the final boss was the Dread Dormammu. Mm-hmm. But we got pretty much all the characters we've come to associate with the Doctor Strange extended universe. We got Mordo. We got Clea. We got the Mindless Ones. We got all the greatest hits, leading to the introduction of one of Lee and Ditko's most inspired creations, that being Eternity. That was kind of the end game of what they were doing here. It was ultimately, because it was in Strange Tales and it was only, you know, so many pages every month, a 12-part series didn't necessarily add up to what we think of as a 12-part series. But man, you can talk about it a little more, how much Lee and Ditko were able to get out of what they're doing with Strange. And then I want to talk a little bit about the appeal of Strange as kind of an exploratory character, and mm-hmm. I'll get more into what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. But first, I want to just hear you gush about how good this story was.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, if you were to take this story and try to retell it today using modern storytelling techniques and sensibilities, this is one of those runs that would be collected in an omnibus. Like...
Yeah,
there is so much story they pack into this that it feels like it's 12-page stories that probably today would be something like 40 to 45 full-length issues. I mean, it really is that dense. And I don't say dense in terms of accusing it of being inaccessible in any way. It's just that's how stories were paced back then. It moves at a clip. It takes you from location to location across the globe. It takes you from dimension to dimension throughout this universe that they've built for Doctor Strange. It introduces you to all these different, or not introduces you, but really brings back all these different characters who have played a role in Doctor Strange's adventures to this point. And they tell the story that is so epic in scope. something that you really didn't even know was possible with Doctor Strange at this point, because his stories have kind of been more focused. They've kind of been one-offs, you know, 12 pagers that might run into two or three different issues, but usually wrap up there at the most. But here, going a full 12 parts is something that feels just unprecedented. And the fact that they do all this, it almost serves as like the perfect bow tied on top of the first 2 years of Doctor Strange stories, while also that ending, man, sets up what feels like could be the next four or five stories to come. I mean, whether it's Dormammu smarting from its defeat, whether it's, you know, the fallout with Baron Mordo, whether it's his rogue followers that are still disciples of his out there gunning for Doctor Strange, whether it's the bomb planted in the Sanctum Sanctorum, there are so many plot elements that we still don't even see fully resolved here, that it really is a perfect example of what serialized storytelling was at this point in the Marvel Universe. I really can't say enough good things about it. And then you throw on top of all of that the iconic and just mind-blowing visual designs that Steve Ditko was bringing to the title for both characters and locales, and it really takes on a look and a feel totally unlike anything else, not just in Marvel at the time, but in all of comics.
To me, a big part of what makes Doctor Strange work, and I have talked about this, is the idea that you have to split him off from the rest of the Marvel Universe. Mm-hmm. As tempting as it is to make him an Avenger or to have him interacting with Spider-Man, and there are great stories with both of those things happening, mm-hmm. I think Strange is so powerful that you need to kind of separate him from everything else. I think the idea that Doctor Strange can go off into other dimensions, mm-hmm. or other realms where he is not the most powerful being, mm-hmm. where he is more of a traveler, more of an underdog character, more of this guy who is punching out of his weight class. You take a concept like Eternity and you put Doctor Strange up against it. It wouldn't make sense to introduce Eternity in the pages of, you know, Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. You need to take the most powerful and kind of potent of the Marvel superheroes and use him to explore these different realms. Now, I have not read the most recent Doctor Strange series, the one that just launched in the last couple months.
Nor have I.
The one by Mark Waid. Mm-hmm. But I do know that it's the premise is basically that he's in space and exploring other realms. And I think that's the way to go, mm-hmm. with Doctor Strange. I think having him be unique, the only human who has seen these sights, who has fought these battles, mm-hmm. makes him special. Mm-hmm. And he's a great gateway character who, if you have a concept that feels too big to be contained to the city of New York or to Spider-Man's adventures, you can get into it with Doctor Strange. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what appealed to you about the serialized storytelling, about just the bigness, horrible word use, the vastness of these concepts,
yeah.
I think comes from that.
Yeah.
I think comes from the fact that Stan and Steve were working not in the Marvel Universe. It wasn't what they were doing on Spider-Man when they were writing stories that were taking place literally down the street from whatever the Fantastic Four were doing. They opened up a whole new world to explore with Doctor Strange. And I think the series benefited greatly from it.
I mean, if you look at some of my favorite characters in comics, the two I'm going to call out being Thor and Green Lantern, I think what appeals to me most about them is that you really get the sense that these characters aren't just part of a larger universe. They almost have universes unto themselves within those universes. What I mean is, look at something like Thor, where you have all of the nine realms and all these different locales and cosmic scope to his stories. And Thor almost has all these threats that he has to deal with that Earth almost feels like a minor concern. Like whatever the Avengers have going on, You can't spend that much time focusing on it as Thor because you have so many responsibilities. Same thing for Green Lantern. You've got 3,600 space sectors. You know, Earth is just a minor, you know, it's there and it's nice, but man, there's so much, there's a much larger universe out there. And Doctor Strange kind of feels that same way here to me early on, in that, yes, he has issues on Earth, and yes, he has things he has to handle, but he has got to deal with a literal multiverse of dimensions in a way that no other character in the Marvel Universe to this point has to deal with. And so it lends an epic scope to his stories that nobody else is really able to touch to this point. Now, I think we're going to start to get there in 1966 as we see Galactus come into the pages of Fantastic Four and start to see that balloon widen for the rest of the Marvel Universe. But to this point, I would argue that Doctor Strange is by far the most epic of characters that we've encountered.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any doubt. And I think it made Doctor Strange unique. And I think as we continue on this odyssey into the history of Marvel, we're going to see periods where Strange is a very interesting character, mm-hmm. and then periods where Strange is a very kind of fall on the wayside character. I would argue that putting him in the Defenders may be the worst thing they ever did.
Yeah.
Because it made him seem not as special. Mm-hmm. He had to associate with other characters, supposed to be on his level. He had to seem more human. Give me Doctor Strange out there fighting the mindless ones.
Right.
And being the only human who can possibly survive such torments. That's the Doctor Strange I want to read about. There have been, don't get me wrong, there have been stories on Earth that have made him work. Obviously, Doctor Strange, The Oath is a great story. Mm-hmm. But man, my Doctor Strange, the stuff I like and the stuff that I think is most loyal to Lee and Ditko's vision is when you really have him separated and doing his own thing.
Absolutely. And just for the record, I would love to see this story used as the basis for the eventual Doctor Strange sequel film. I think that would be a nice touch, and it kind of would make sense based on the story they told in the first film.
Yeah, no, I think it would be a slam dunk, and I think it's a story they should tell. We'll see where they go with it. Before we leave Strange behind and move on to our last topic of the evening, I do want to touch on the fact that you guys really gave a lot of shine, you in particular, Nick, gave a lot of shine to the Dread Dormammu mm-hmm. for this particular year.
Yeah.
So I will ask two questions. One, is this the best Dormammu story ever? And two, what makes Dormammu work as a villain in this story that hasn't necessarily translated over to some of his other appearances?
Well, it's the best. It's certainly the best Dormammu story that I've read, because I haven't right. read a ton of them. But what makes him work is it's almost like he becomes Doctor Strange's Doctor Doom. And what I mean by that is you get the impression that he is a character who has existed for many millennia and who has never really tasted defeat before, to the point where once he tastes it for the first time, his ego will not allow him to process the idea that he could possibly be beaten, let alone be beaten by a mere mortal. And so he develops this, like, unhealthy obsession with Doctor Strange. Like, Dormammu in these early pages has been tasked with the responsibility of holding back the Mindless Ones from rampaging across his dimension and slaughtering people and causing great ruin. And there are multiple times throughout these early Doctor Strange pages where he almost loses sight of that because he's so laser focused on getting back at Stephen Strange for possibly getting one over on him. And so the idea here in this story that Strange beats him again, I can't wait to see where he goes from here, because after the way he took the first defeat, I can't wait to see Dormammu completely off the hinges in the issues to come.
I wonder if you haven't in that just kind of identified the problem with Dormammu down the line, because Dormammu, well, he might be a great Doctor Strange villain. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. He's not really in the pantheon of great Marvel villains.
No.
I don't think. I think he's a great visual.
Yeah.
Fantastic visual villain, but not a lot of meat on the bone, it feels like sometimes. And I wonder if it isn't the specialness of the fact that he hasn't been beaten for millennia, and then Strange beats him, and then the fact that the more Strange beats him, the less special he becomes.
Right.
Like with a villain like Dr. Doom, you can beat him as many times as you want. He's got so much to him that he can keep coming back for more. With Dormammu, really, the appeal to him is that he's ridiculously powerful. So once you see him taste defeat, and he it's almost like, again, to go back to wrestling, it's the first time you see the monster heel lose, you know that, you know, he can be beaten.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he's not as special anymore. So I wonder if that's kind of what applies here to Dormammu.
That makes a lot of sense, and I think it's something we'll probably see, because you're right. Like, I wouldn't ever consider Dormammu to be a top-level, you know, general Marvel villain. But, you know, he kind of is, next to Baron Mordo anyway, the main Doctor Strange villain.
Yeah.
And at least in these early stories, that's something that I feel is warranted. Now, we'll see how other writers handle him in the future, how they decide to take that character forward, because I think there is a potential for him to become something of a one-note character. But to this point, for this story, that's not the case.
Absolutely not. So we said that Doctor Strange is only 12 pages in Strange Tales. That means something else has to be going on in those other 12 pages. And at least for part of 1965, those 12 pages were devoted to a new look at a familiar character. Mm-hmm. And that is Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Mm-hmm. A lot of us, of course, are much more familiar with this incarnation of Nick Fury.
Yes.
As opposed to the Sergeant Fury incarnation. You guys made the very astute point on Marvel Age that I think he was, outside of, I don't know if Superman and Batman, well, I guess Superman and Batman had multiple books at this point, but certainly Fury was the first Marvel character to have to star in multiple titles simultaneously. Mm-hmm. As you had Sergeant Fury and Silent Commandos still going, and now Nick Fury is over in Strange Tales doing this Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. gimmick. Now, the one thing you guys didn't cover because it wasn't on your reading list, and I don't know if you knew this or not, was that Nick Fury was introduced into the modern Marvel Universe in the pages of Fantastic Four.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, so in one of it's the same issue that has the first appearance of the Hate Monger.
Okay.
basically, an older Nick Fury shows up working for the FBI, so kind of like a proto Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. type deal.
Okay.
But clearly, Stan and Jack love this character.
Right.
They wanted to do something with him. I think their desire to do something with him combined with a desire to want to tell these spy stories, mm-hmm. That, you know, again, we're very much, you can nitpick over whether or not it's Man from U.N.C.L.E. or James Bond. I think at the end of the day, it's always James Bond. But, you know, they wanted to do these spy stories. They thought Nick Fury was a character who had potential. I think they really like the idea of bringing him into the modern Marvel Universe and giving him a place. And what they end up doing is creating a lot of cool concepts, a lot of neat framework. Kirby doing some really good work as far as drawing the technology and drawing the spy adventures, but really S.H.I.E.L.D. And I know you might remember what it was an acronym for back then.
I don't.
It's Supreme Headquarters something. It's terrible.
Supreme Headquarters International Espionage something something.
Something something. Yeah, it's really unimportant. But in the pages of Strange Tales, we get Nick Fury as an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. We get the concept of S.H.I.E.L.D. We get the helicarrier. We get Hydra. We get everything that would eventually work. But for whatever reason, it just doesn't click under Lee and Kirby, which is very weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's tough because, like, I dig the idea of an espionage book set in this version of the Marvel Universe, and I think the plot of it is fairly interesting, but I kind of feel like just picking up Nick Fury wholesale from World War II and dropping him into the story doesn't necessarily work, and it isn't until a few years later with Jim Steranko and some other subsequent writers where you start to play up the idea of Fury as the, like, paranoid spy that, yeah, that the book and the concept really starts to sing.
Yeah, I think you're dead on. I think that obviously we'll get to the Steranko stuff, which really elevates Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. and Hydra, all these characters, to a whole nother level, to the point where they would become staples of not just the MU, but the MCU as well. I mean, S.H.I.E.L.D. is a central part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and of the Ultimate Universe.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I think in this case, yeah, you nailed it. It's Stan and Jack trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. They had a cool character in Nick Fury, but they had already found a place for him. With Captain America, making him the man out of time, making him part of the Avengers worked. It immediately catapulted him into the Marvel Universe. He was a hit. With Nick Fury, I think people didn't mind seeing him as Sergeant Fury, but yeah, they weren't clamoring for the modern day adventures of Nick Fury. The spy and espionage genre was clearly something that could be mined in the Marvel Universe. It had a place in the Marvel Universe, but I just feel like the best stuff that Lee and Kirby did was kind of tee it up. Almost, you know, if it's basketball, these guys gave the assist, and someone else had to really drive it home. And
are you suggesting that it was a gift for later writers?
I was not going to say that, because that is a that's just an overused trope that it's been beat into the ground. No, I was not going to say. I was struggling for ways that I was using a ham-fisted basketball analogy to maneuver my way around saying the words you wanted me to say. That's how far I went.
Listen, here on Place to Be Nation Pop, we lean into our stereotypes and our bad catchphrases. Yep.
Yeah, no. Well, I think I've created. Yeah, all right. Let's lean into it then. Yes, Stan and Jack left a gift for later creators,
right,
with the creation of S.H.I.E.L.D. and bringing Fury into the modern universe. And I think, again, you nailed it by saying that once Steranko got a hold of him, and Steranko's whole thing, whether you read his Captain America or his Fury, is the paranoid hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it reminds me of that show, The Prisoner. Which I've never watched, so I don't know how it reminds me of it. but it's like that in the sense that I think because there were DC stories that were based on The Prisoner, so that's where I got it from. What was the book that DC did that was like very prison? It was right after Final Crisis. It had Nemesis in it. I'll look it up and talk about it in the next episode.
Yeah.
But regardless, the idea of Fury, of Cap, of these guys who are not in their proper time period being super paranoid, and especially it worked in a spy book, and just being like looking over his shoulder, looking for betrayal, looking for who's trying to wrong him in every sense. Yeah, Steranko did that, and it totally worked. He made it much more psychedelic. He made it much more claustrophobic, and I'm sure we'll get to talk about his S.H.I.E.L.D. stories coming up. But this, yeah, I think it was... It was a half-baked idea of cool espionage, and then trying to force Nick Fury into it that didn't really work.
Yeah, I think it. But unlike something like, you know, Incredible Hulk is the thing I want to compare it to. Whereas, you know, Incredible Hulk early on, I think was kind of a bust. The Hulk stuck around, but they had to overhaul so much of that character and concept to make him capable of enduring. Whereas with this. This really does feel like they have the foundation here. They just need
someone else to tell the story.
Yeah, they just don't know what to put on the foundation. And I think Steranko is going to be the one that's going to come along and really help people to understand what this character can be and set him up as being, you know, he's kind of the glue of the entire Marvel Universe at this point. That's the role
for years,
over the years that Nick Fury has taken on. And it's interesting to go back and look at it at the beginnings of that and see that definitely was not the case from the earliest issues.
I would almost argue that it took someone who didn't hold Fury in as high regard as Lee and Kirby obviously did.
Yeah, when you don't hold him as precious, you can make these changes, right?
Exactly. They were afraid to take risks with this character because they clearly loved this character. And they didn't want to, you know, make big changes to him. But then you get a Steranko and other writers who would really, you know, take Nick Fury in a different direction.
Yep.
Yeah. So that brings us to the end of 1965. We did it, Nick. We covered everything.
Absolutely.
Any final thoughts on the year that was as we head into 66? I'm really excited for 66 because I feel like 65 gave us so many intriguing setups. Even just looking at this episode with the new Avengers team, which we didn't even get into the fact that I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that decades later, it would take like Brian Michael Bendis coming to Marvel and being like, why aren't the Avengers just all their biggest heroes to kind of reset the board on that? But that's another episode. But we have the new Avengers. We have Spider-Man going into college. We have Doctor Strange, like you said, being set up for multiple storylines. And we have all this stuff paving the way for what should be a pretty interesting 1966.
Yeah, I think, especially when you look at it from the Avengers standpoint, 65 was the final step of Marvel laying down the building blocks of the universe. Because now you've got Spider-Man moving on from high school into college. You've got the Avengers roster turning over. You have got the Fantastic Four with the finally the wedding of Reed and Sue. So you have all these things in place, and now you can take it to the next level. 65, to me, has been by far the best year we've read so far, but I get the impression that bigger and better things are on the horizon in 66 and out through the end of the decade.
Absolutely, man. I'm looking forward to covering it. Nick, I told you before we got on this call that I am greatly enjoying what you and your partner in crime, Greg Phillips, are doing over at Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Thank you, sir.
With Dark Knight Month.
Yes. Crazy July. To think it's been 10 years, man. 10 years.
It's ridiculous. I remember seeing Dark Knight at a movie theater in New Jersey with my wife, who asked me why it was so long. which would pretty much set up our relationship as far as going to movies together. But you guys are speaking of so long, you guys are doing epic shows to show your love. And I said to you over the phone that I think there are a lot of people who don't love anything in life as much as you and Greg love Dark Knight.
And that's definitely true. The Dark Knight, as you will hear if you listen to our most recent episode, it's my favorite movie of all time. Like it became that very quickly upon its release, and has never really, nothing has ever approached it in the years since. And part of that is just the feeling that it gave me the first time I saw it in the theater, that nothing has ever been able to recreate. It's my favorite take on my favorite character. And if you want to hear me gush more about it, go listen to the most recent episode of Hard Traveling Fanboys. Next up, we'll be finishing off the trilogy with a look back at Dark Knight Rises. And then wrapping up Dark Knight Month, we're going to do a countdown of our five favorite scenes from across the trilogy, which will be pretty tough to narrow down, I think.
And from what I understand, Hard Traveling Fanboys is a fairly long-running podcast.
Yeah, we are about the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. So there you are.
There you have it. Of course, you can also hear Nick regularly on the Marvel Age podcast, which will be delving into 1966 coming up very soon. As for me, this is pretty much it, guys. I just do Masterclass, and then I go into a hole for the rest of the month. No, I'm very active on Twitter at Ben J. Morse. I'm very active on Instagram at Ben Morse 882. And Nick, of course, we're both very active on Facebook, where you can visit the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and talk to us about anything.
Yeah, I mean, reach out to us if you want to get the reading list that we're doing for this Marvel Age project. We'll be happy to get those into your hands, and that way you can read along with us and be prepared for each episode as it prepares to drop. We're going to be doing 1966 Part 1, as we mentioned, in the next episode of Marvel Age. And so if you're listening and you want to read along, just real quick, we're going to be covering Amazing Spider-Man 31 through 33 and 39 through 40, as well as Fantastic Four 46 through 53. So if you want to, you know, go subscribe to Marvel Unlimited, the Webby Award-winning Marvel Unlimited, I might add. Go subscribe to that and read those issues. That way you'll be ready to go when the next episode of Marvel Age drops.
And if up to this point you've been wondering what the big deal is about Fantastic Four and you haven't really gotten it, this next episode should hopefully turn you around on that.
I'm looking forward to it. I've enjoyed the Fantastic Four we read at this point, but I know it has not quite hit the heights that I know the book is famous for.
Absolutely. And we'll have more editions of Masterclass coming up covering 1966 Part 1 and beyond. I had some people reach out to me about wanting to make guest appearances on the show. So we may move from a two-man booth to a three-man booth. I don't know how soon that's going to happen. So stay tuned.
Well, you're
going to get.
You are the master of Masterclass's destiny. So I look forward to hearing what you got on the horizon.
Totally ripping off something I already said earlier this episode. It's like it's almost as if I was giving you a gift.
There you go.
All right, I'm embracing it, guys. Thank you for listening to Marvel Age Masterclass. Please hit up me, Nick, and the rest of the gang. We are eager to talk to you about Marvel Comics and all other things. Until next time, class dismissed.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We'll be right back.